Hi, welcome back to Root Canal Academy, where root canal mastery is the ultimate goal. We are in the root canal game. We are going to talk about the post game and the press conference after the post game. First off, in the post game, I want to talk about post-operative instructions that I give my patients after the root canal procedure is completed. And I want to talk about the post-operative medications that I give and I recommend for patients that after a procedure. Okay. First off, I think it would be wise to have a post-operative instruction card for all of your patients, especially when you do extractions, also when you do root canal treatment, because that just seems to be the patients only catch probably 20 to 30% of what we say verbal. So it's always nice to have a card that they can read it. They can read a written print, and I think this will prevent a lot of questions and calling and answer a lot of their questions and instead of them having to call us and ask. So we have a post-operative instruction card that we give all of the patients. I go over verbally post-operative instructions myself if I have time. It's a rare occasion if I don't have enough time and my assistant does it. But I will go over briefly a summary of the important instructions. My assistant will reiterate those instructions, and then my front office gal, when checking them out, will hand them a post-op card, will underline and circle and kind of highlight some of the more important instructions. We highlight always that they need a restoration within 4 weeks, a final restoration, and we underline and circle it by their general dentist. Now, you won't have that problem. You'll be most likely placing the restoration. But then we kind of highlight and underline the medications and the discomfort they're going to experience for 3 to 5 days. Post-operative instructions, I tell them, I just completed a surgery inside your tooth. And I say the word surgery on purpose because I want them to understand that what we did is invasive. In a sense, it's invasive. It's not quite as invasive as surgery, but they understand that when you do, it's a treatment, it's a procedure, they're going to have discomfort. Just like a surgery, you have healing discomfort. And with root canal treatment, you're going to have healing discomfort. I also tell the patient, don't chew on the treated tooth for 5 days. The biggest complaint that I receive and hear is it hurts to chew on the tooth. So we've kind of just over the years have said, you know what, just act like it's like a sprained ankle. You limp on a sprained ankle. You have a sprained tooth. Just limp on your sprained tooth and chew on the other side. Give it 5 days to heal. Then try soft things and you will get so many fewer complaints, because the biggest complaint they get is it hurts to chew. And that's just because what we do when we do our root canal treatment, the periodontal ligament, the PDL, can get inflamed. The periapical tissue can get inflamed. And so therefore, when they bite down and push on that tooth, it hurts. It's sore. So we recommend just chewing on the other side and kind of laying off that tooth. What I do is I'll give the patient an ibuprofen tablet either before treatment or after treatment. I actually forget a lot of the time before, but we'll give them one ibuprofen tablet right after treatment. And this is before the anesthetic wears off. I want to get ahead of the pain and not be behind the pain, because once you're behind the pain, it's hard to get to catch up. If you're ahead of the discomfort with the ibuprofen tablet, then that seems to really help. The studies show that helps with pain relief. I recommend 3 times a day for the first 3 days, take 600 milligrams of Advil or Motrin or ibuprofen. Now, you have to be careful. I've had patients take 3 600-milligram ibuprofen tablets. Okay, it only happened a few times, but I was like, no, 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 no. So I sometimes will say, do you have Advil or ibuprofen? And if they say, I have Advil, I say, take 3 of the baby Advil. It'll equal 600 milligrams. Just like the baby aspirin is 81 milligrams. All Advil is 200 milligrams, but I'll say take 3 baby Advil, because I don't want them to take 3 ibuprofen tablets. Or I'll say take 1 ibuprofen tablet as long as it's 600 milligrams. Okay. Another thing is some patients, they don't want to do any narcotics, which is great. I'd rather not have them do narcotics, but they can do 3 Advil and 2 extra strength Tylenol at the same time. All right. There was a study that showed that actually did better than 3-Advil and 2-Extra-Strength Tylenol did better than just Vicodin alone. So you can do, they can do 3-Advil, 2-Extra-Strength Tylenol, or they can do 3-Advil, and you're supposed to wait 6 hours before you do 3 more Advil. And at the 3-hour mark, they could do 2-Extra-Strength Tylenol. So then it's only 3 hours more until they do their Advil, their 600 milligram Advil dose. And then 3 hours later, they're taking 2-Extra-Strength Tylenol. It's kind of like if you have kids, when your young babies or your young kids had a fever and you kind of dosed them with Advil and Tylenol, trying to help just help with some of the pain. Obviously, the Advil and the fever, but the Tylenol with some of the pain and stuff. So that's just one way you can do it. Another thing, I do give Norco, okay, or Vicodin. Same thing, but I do give 5 milligrams. And I tell them this is more of a nighttime drug, a rescue drug, and that I'd rather have them try the 3-Advil and do that every 6 hours. But if they need the rescue drug, it's always nice for them to have it and to give the prescription. So obviously, you got to be careful on who you give Norco to and all this. Tell them you can't drink alcohol and you can't drive with this. So I always try to tell them it's a nighttime drug. You don't want to take it at work. And I tell them, don't stop taking your Advil. Don't stop taking your Advil just because you start the Vicodin. A lot of patients will just stop taking Advil and only do the Vicodin, and because they're in discomfort. I want them to still take the Advil, preferably 3-Advil, and then in between the 6-hour at your window of your waiting for the next Advil dose, you could take the Vicodin. You can take 3-Advil and a Vicodin together, okay? Because most of it's metabolized Vicodin by the liver and Advil by the kidney. So you can do that. If needed, it's not the end of the world if you took them together, but it could be better to go in between two. You could do both ways. Again, preoperative pain severity indicates postoperative pain severity. So if they come in with a ton of pain or a nasty infection that's just growing, and we're trying to intervene and stop the train, well, the train's going to keep running down the track, the train of infection or the train of pain, and it's going to take a few days for the train of pain or the train of infection to slow down and stop. So we have to make sure we are clear with the patient saying, hey, it's not going to go away. It does not get better immediately. It's going to take time to heal. You've got to do your part, not chewing, taking care of your body, taking your Advil, extra strength Tylenol, your Vicodin. Again, you have to tell them too, they can't take extra-strength Tylenol and Vicodin together because there is acetaminophen or Tylenol in Vicodin. So we have that on our card, and we circle that on our post-operative instruction card if we do give them Vicodin. And that post-operative instruction card should be, I will get that on the site so you can download that and just change your own name, and you could just use that post-operative instruction card for your endo card at your office and just change the name, put your name on it. I don't mind one bit. I think that would make it easy for you guys to do that. Advil or what about antibiotics? When do I give antibiotics? It's funny. It's kind of a lot of it's a judgment call. Obviously, if they have an acute apical abscess, I always give antibiotics and I always give a loading dose. I like to start If they any type of infection, I do start with 1 gram of amoxicillin, and I give 500 milligrams of amoxicillin 3 times a day for 7 days. Now, if it's really nasty and the patient's healthy, I will give them clindamycin, and I'll start with a loading dose. You always start with a loading dose if it's infection. I give them 600 milligrams of clindamycin as a loading dose, and then 300 milligrams of clindamycin QID 4 times a day for 7 days. Now, it's a little rough. I know it can be rough with on the patient's stomach, and also there's that ulcerative colitis issues, and so you have to be careful with that. There are times I've given this drug if they're allergic to amoxicillin, but they needed the antibiotic, but it wasn't a severe case. I've given 150 milligrams 4 times a day with a 300 milligram loading dose. You could also do Augmentin, which is amoxicillin and clavulanic acid. You can go that route also. If you didn't want to do clindamycin, you can do something a little stronger. That works very well too. If they're allergic to amoxicillin, I go right to clindamycin. You can sometimes give Keflex if they're allergic to amoxicillin, even though there's a 10% cross-reactivity. It's a little bit touchy. If they only have hives with amoxicillin or penicillin, then Keflex is a possibility. The problem is the pharmacists go crazy. The pharmacists always call me about that. And even though it's 10% chance, and I just tell the patient, I explain to them what it could be. But if they have hives, it's most likely not an anaphylactic shock. And I say, just have Benadryl with you. But I try to avoid that, of course. Just it's too much confusion. But I have had to do that at times, and it still worked fine. If they have anaphylactic shock from penicillin, then you don't want to even give them any chance with Keflex. So that's just something to think about on postoperative antibiotics. I also give antibiotics if there's a sinus tract. I do not give antibiotics just because there's a sinus tract. A lot of dentists do that. You don't need to. The infection's draining. The patient has no pain when there's a sinus tract because any pressure of the infection forming in the bone is able to drain out the sinus tract, out the usually the buccal sinus tract. So just because there's a sinus tract, I do not give antibiotics. You could. I mean, I have before. It's not like it's absolutely a no-go, but just in general, I don't. If it's a really severe necrotic case on a retreatment, or if it's a nasty retreatment with black pigmented, bacteria, you could just see, I don't know if it's black pigmented, but it's all black inside, or the really nasty necrotic case with some purulence, but they don't have swelling. I will sometimes give antibiotics there, and I'll give amoxicillin loading dose or clindamycin loading dose. And the bottom line, if it's Christmas or Thanksgiving or it's a long weekend, it's a 4-day weekend, and it's a nasty patient, it's a nasty case, I may just give an antibiotic and tell them take it. Or I have done this too. I give them an antibiotic and tell them, look, you have this. I want you to fill it, and you have it if you need it. Call me if you have any questions about it. If you start having going the wrong direction and you're not getting better after 2 or 3 days, you're getting worse. There's some swelling. You're feeling worse. Then start the antibiotic. If you have questions, call me. Another thing is if someone's going on a trip, if they're going back east, I'm California, if they're going back east or out of the country, I'll give them I'll write an antibiotic if we just did a root canal and it's a necrotic case. And I tell them, look, go fill this so you have it, okay, just in case. So if you're in Mexico and you needed it, you have it, you can just take it. It's kind of a get out of jail free card, a little bit of an antibiotic. So that's just kind of what I do with antibiotics. The tried and true answer is you only give antibiotics if there's swelling, fever, all that, redness but basically there are times when you kind of use your intuition and you just give it to them. And there's those patients that are just crazy, and you touch their chin and they act like you just cut their leg off, or you do a root canal and both legs have been amputated. And you know what I mean? It's like, That's the kind of, so you give them an antibiotic sometimes just to, just for everyone to feel better. Now, okay, let's switch gears. What about recall? So I finished the root canal treatment. There's a lesion present, or even if it's necrotic, I will recall it 6 months. Sometimes if it's a IP case, irreversible pulpitis - symptomatic. So it's a vital case with lots of tissue in the canal system. I usually don't always recall that unless it's a really cool looking case or an interesting case, then I'll recall. We have a ton of patients on a recall system. What we do is we just go six months from that day. We put them in the computer on the right hand side of whatever software you have to call them for recall. And that's how we do it because they won't remember their appointment if we gave an appointment 6 months from now. Or you could appoint them and you could call them a week before, or a couple days before. Whatever, you guys know that, whatever's best. We usually do 6 months. In some cases, I will do 3 months. If it's a really nasty case, if it's a trauma case sometimes, if it's a repair, a perforation, if it's a mistake case where there was a mistake and I'd repaired a perforation or something funny was going on, I will recall 3 months. If it's an adolescent with trauma, I may recall at a month, 4 weeks to 6 weeks, and take x-rays. So when trauma cases, you're going to recall much sooner. I usually do 6 months, but some of the nasty cases, you go 3 months. So it's never wrong to go 3 months and get x-rays. I will do x-rays at 3 months, 2 x-rays, a straight and a shift. On our recall, I will do a straight and a shift at 6 months, a straight PA and a shift PA, and I'll ask them, how is the tooth feeling? And I will say, hopefully, can you chew on it? Does it have? Do you have spontaneous pain? Nope, nope. But every now and then someone tells me it hurts when I take my finger and I tap on the side of the tooth, okay? I get that every now and then. And I don't know if that's just there's some still tissue in there and there's a little bit of chronic inflammation of the PDL, but it's real light. It's still subclinical almost, other than they can put their finger and touch it, but they can chew on it. And there's not a lesion. Everything looks clean. The PDL's not widened. I will watch that, keep an eye on it, and usually it kind of sorts to resolve. But every now and then you have to retreat those cases. But that's the biggest complaint you have. You're going to get patients that say, you know, it bugs me when I take my finger and I push on the side, or my tongue hits that one side, it feels different, and or my toothbrush hits it, it's sore. But my first question is, can you chew on it normally? And if they say yes, I typically will watch it and tell them, look, I think your ligament's just inflamed. That cushions the tooth against the bone. It's a little bit of inflammation, a little chronic inflammation. Let's keep an eye on it. If it gets to the point where something, you know, was getting worse, we could always retreat and redo the root canal for free. I don't actually like to say that right away, but later on, if they come back another time, we start talking about it then, all right? So now that was post-game. Let's get to the press conference. Post-game of the root canal game. You've done all the interviews on the field. That was the post-operative instructions and the post-operative meds. Now we're at the press conference of the root canal game, and the press conference is flare-up. How do you treat a flare-up? And, God forbid, a sodium hypochlorite accident, a bleach accident, okay? How are we going to handle that? What happens? How do you avoid that? Okay, so let's talk about a flare-up. A flare-up is about, the studies show, it's about a 10% incidence, okay, and it's higher in middle-aged females. It's higher with patients that have preoperative pain. It seems to be higher in necrotic and retreatment cases. And again, pre-op pain indicates post-op pain. How do you treat a flare-up? So how do you treat a flare-up? Well, someone comes in, a flare-up is they are suddenly, you've done the root canal, it's either completed or it has calcium hydroxide in it, and now they're swollen and they're worse off than from when they started. And it's going to happen. It happens to all of us. It happens to me. It's going to happen to you if you do enough root canals. Again, it's a 10% incidence, plus or minus 5%. Okay, so it's going to happen. Well, the first thing you want to do is if you do have a flare-up and it's a localized abscess, you want to establish drainage. Okay, you want to establish drainage by doing an incision and drainage, and you want to give an antibiotic with a loading dose. You also want to follow the patient and call them the next day, okay? If it's diffuse swelling, okay, the diffuse swelling, I won't always try an IND, although the oral surgeons will tell you you should always try for drainage on swelling, even if it's diffuse, okay? So that was interesting when I heard that. But sometimes when it's real diffuse, I don't always do an IND. I give an antibiotic with a loading dose. Some patients will come in to me either a post flare-up from either another dentist, or sometimes the tooth's so infected, it's not even a flare-up. Well, it's flaring up, but I haven't done the treatment. They're so swollen, I can't even do anything. I give them an antibiotic, and I tell them, look, you may have to go to the emergency room and get IV antibiotics, because that way it'll get in your bloodstream so fast, and it'll be able to get to the site of infection. So I always prep the patient. You may have to go to the emergency room when they're so swollen and they're so bad. Usually I get these cases that I haven't treated. When I get a flare-up, I'm usually able to manage it without them going to the ER because I can drain it or I can give them antibiotics, okay? So that's a little difference there. But I follow these people daily. Sometimes I've used an Endo Explorer to pop or to drain the localized abscesses, the flare-ups, where it's like a big giant pimple right over the tooth you treated. I pop it with an Endo Explorer. It's just less of a hassle getting a blade out, and it gets a fair amount of pus out. But really the best way to do it is you make an incision with like a 15 blade, and you make it in a vertical direction to the tooth, a vertical, not a horizontal, which I'm still not sure how big of a deal that is, but it used to be horizontal, but now they're teaching vertical incision because you don't cross as much anatomy with a vertical incision. And you go right to the bone. So you find the localized IND, the localized abscess, and you drain it right to the bone, and you're trying to get purulence, trying to get pus out. You're trying to drain that. They're going to feel instantly better if you can drain it. When you do your incision in the vertical direction, okay, be mindful of anatomy, all right? Be careful. Mental foramen, of course, between the first premolar and second premolar, anywhere around the bicuspid, first and second lower bicuspids, be careful there of the mental foramen. You don't really have to go that far anyway when you do an IND. It's really, 8 to 10 millimeters of an incision, and that should be enough to get to drain it. Purulence is the ultimate goal, and you want to remember to go to the bone. It's going to hurt the patient. It's usually, you can't always get these people completely numb. Use 3% mepivacaine because it's got the lowest pKa, and it's such an acidic environment in that abscess and in that localized swelling. It's so acidic and hot. The mepivacaine works a little better than the other anesthetics, so you can use mepivacaine initially. Okay, so what about, God forbid, I even hate to talk about this, but it's important to talk about, because if something happens, if it ever happens, you want to know how to at least handle it without using too much profanity. A bleach accident, sodium hypochlorite accident, okay? We've all seen the pictures in the journals. We've all seen the pictures in the textbooks. They're nasty. The patient's all bruised. We know they're in severe pain, all of that stuff. Sometimes they're hospitalized. First off, the way to avoid this is to use a side-vented irrigation needle, to be careful and slow when you inject, and never, ever, 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 ever bind the irrigating needle in the canal. Keep the needle loose and then apply gentle pressure when irrigating. You don't have to go all the way down the canal and be 2 millimeters, 3 millimeters from the working length. I just go about halfway down the canal now, okay? I think it's better to go halfway down, even 7, 8 millimeters into the canal. I don't think we have to go all the way down to the end right now. I think we're able to if you give it enough soak time and you shape it enough, the bleach gets down into the apical area in the apical one-third, okay? Now, how do you know you have a sodium hypochlorite accident? How are you going to know? And have I ever had one? Okay, well, I will talk about that in just a minute. First off, you will know right away. You will know. You will know right away because the patient will suddenly be in absolute severe agony, severe pain, all right? So suddenly, he will feel like his cheek is on fire. Patient will feel like the cheek is on fire, and they will be moaning, basically, and you kind of know, because it usually occurs right after you've just irrigated. And the way this is going to happen is if you're in a hurry, you're trying to go fast, and you're irrigating quickly, and you sort of force it in there, and it binds just for a second, and you force it down. And if you force it too much, you could get a sodium hypochlorite accident. And I've done that many times where I've actually been in a hurry, the needle bound, and I just shot out a little bit of anesthetic, but just caught myself, and I took a breath, I held my breath and said, "Dear Lord, I just pray I did not just put bleach in the periapical tissues." And I've been lucky, I haven't had that. So if I would have been more aggressive and injected another second or two, I might have had the accident. Another thing with the sodium hypochlorite accident, bruising will occur fairly fast, okay? I had a patient that they came in with purulence. They had it was number 4, and he was on the new blood thinners, and I worked on him, I placed calcium hydroxide, and the guy blew up. He blew up a couple days later, and he had bruising all over, and it looked like a bleach accident. Okay, now he had some discomfort, but he never had severe pain, and he never had his face on fire during treatment, and he was on blood thinners, on the clopidogrel, the Plavix, but the newer blood thinners. I can't remember the exact name, and so I really think it was more of a blood thinner and infection combination than a sodium hypochlorite accident. But if you saw the pictures in the lecture, you could see that it looks like a sodium hypochlorite accident, and the referring dentist said, "Reed, I think it's a sodium hypochlorite accident." So I really didn't think so. I've had a few accidents where I've injected bleach, and then right after the tooth had profuse bleeding. That's another thing that could happen. If you get bleach into the apical tissues, You can get profuse bleeding from the tooth into the from the tissue into the tooth, and this did not cause really any severe pain at the point at that time. But that did bleed for like 20 minutes, and I was like, oh boy, shoot, I think I know what I did. So that's my own. Those are the things that kind of happened to me, but I haven't had a, you know, man, knock on wood, a severe sodium hypochlorite accident. I have talked to a number of patients, though, in my office who have had them, and I've questioned them because it's a rare event. When they do find out, they explain to me that they had it. They don't always call it an accident, but they call it, they know what it is, and I basically interview them, and I get details of how it felt, how long did it hurt, what'd you do, all this. So I'm trying to collect data on this. It's a very interesting thing, and let's say pray that never happens to us. Okay, so let's say it did happen. It did, okay? Something happened. Somehow we got a sodium hypochlorite accident. What do we do? How do we manage that? Well, the first thing you want to do is you want to try to dilute that bleach in the periapical tissues by irrigating with saline. Okay, you want to irrigate with saline, and yes, you would bind the needle and force the saline into the tissue. I would PIPS, use photon-induced photoacoustic streaming to push the saline into and to try to dilute the apically extruded bleach in the tissues, try to dilute everything. I would then proceed to use Marcaine, which is a long-acting anesthetic, to try to get some anesthesia in there because they are in severe pain. So use long-acting anesthetics. Give them narcotics. Talk about a great time to give them narcotics. This is the time. If you even wanted to go to Percocet, you could even give them Percocet. Okay? You're just, at this point, trying to manage this severe pain and not get sued. Okay? This root canal also will be free. Next, you want to give antibiotics to manage any possible infection, because there's going to be tissue damage, periapical tissue damage. There is a possibility of infection, especially if you're working on an infected tooth. So what a great time for the bacteria to infect the tissue is in damaged inflamed tissue, okay? Have the patient use cold compresses, anything to make them feel better. Icing their face will always help. You're going to recall this patient daily, and you're going to call them daily to check on them. Okay, so I hope and pray that never happens to you or me or anyone out there. All right, but now we know how to manage them if that does ever happen. All right, so we're almost done with the press conference. Now, let's talk about something that's very unpleasant, or not quite as unpleasant as a sodium hypochlorite accident, but not much better. Root canal failure. Okay, what now? What if your case fails, God forbid? Well, let's talk about the success rate from the research. Irreversible pulpitis cases, their success rate is 90 to 95%. These are cases that are hyperemic, that have tissue, that are vital cases, that have tissue in the canals, but they're irreversible pulpitis cases. You still can get 5 to 10 failures out of 100 patients, all right? I always think there should be no reason we have failures with IP cases. The only time I think I see them most of the time is missed MB2s and the upper first molars. That's really the most common. But I've had failures. I've had failures on my own where I look back and it was an IP symptomatic and the damn thing failed. And I just go, oh my gosh, how embarrassing is that? So the success rate of an IP case is 90 to 95%. If it's necrotic, if you have a necrotic case with a lesion or with a parle, periapical radiolucency or an apical lesion, the success rate is about 80 to 85%, okay, plus or minus 5 or 10% based on studies. At an 80 to 85% success rate, so that means 50 to 20 patients out of 100 will be back with failure, okay? And then you have to decide if you're going to retreat it or send it to the endodontist for retreatment. Okay, and that's why the next course is going to be something called simple retreatment, and to be able to learn how to retreat the simpler cases. Okay, what about retreatment with a lesion? Well, retreatment with a parle has about an 80% success rate, and surgery has about a 70 to 85% success rate. although depending on what it is, it can be up to 95% success. So there's a lot of variation in the studies, but just kind of a general idea, it's about 70-85% of the time. Basically, every time you touch the tooth, going from non-surgical root canal treatment to non-surgical retreatment to a surgery, the success rate seems to drop a little bit each time, okay? So that's sort of the success and failure outcomes. Again, simple retreatment is going to be the next Root Canal Academy course. I'm looking forward to that, and that'll be a good course because I think that, so there's a lot of cases that general dentists can retreat successfully that aren't so complicated. And especially if you're treating molar teeth, you know, you really can retreat some of these cases, some molars, but yeah, even premolars and incisors, and we'll get into that, okay? Thank you so much. I hope you've enjoyed the Root Canal Academy, where root canal mastery is the ultimate goal, and I hope this has helped you practice effective, efficient, and most importantly, excellent endodontics. Thank you so much for your time.